Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an update on the New York State budget after both houses of the state legislature release their proposals, budget proposals this week. Then for our piece segment, we discuss the March 16th Rachel Corrie Palestinian Rights Vigil taking place in Albany. Later on, we hear about the celebration this Sunday at the Media Sanctuary of the work of Dr. David Carpenter. We then have part two of an interview with Jean Fey about her decades-long effort in bringing Dismantle Racism workshops to the Capital District. And we finish with a live interview with Matt Shapiro of the National Alliance of on Mental Illness in New York State. But first, headlines.
A group of Glenmont residents seeking to block the Port of Albany's wind turbine tower factory from being built near their homes have filed a second lawsuit. The new suit claims residents were not given proper notice and that a proper environmental review was not done by the town of Bethlehem.
The Times Union reports that the Roman Catholic Diocese of Albany has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy as it deals with the financial impact of hundreds of civil claims resulting from decades of child sexual abuse and cover-ups. The diocese claims this is the best way to ensure that all the victims get some compensation. Parishes and Catholic schools of the diocese are separately incorporated and are not part of the bankruptcy filing.
The two houses of the state legislature have passed their one-house budget bills, setting up a two-week sprint to finalize the budget before April 1st, a deadline that many observers believe will not be met this year. The governor and legislators have significant differences over tax hikes for the rich, how best to build new affordable housing, bail, tuition, hikes at SUNY, charter schools in New York City, and other key items. We will have more details in our first segment.
During the pandemic, fourth graders in New York lost twice as much ground in math and reading than the national average. During the 49 weeks of schools being closed before classes went back to being fully in person, New York children only learned the equivalent of 19 weeks of schooling. Nationally, the results were half as bad. The state controller said that schools should reinvest more of their federal COVID relief funds to help students catch up.
The Associated Press reports attacks on free speech are rising across the United States. In recent years, many states have reverted to the anti-speech tactics employed by people like Senator Joe McCarthy during the, quote, Red Scare of the early 1950s. Bans on books and drag performances are also growing increasingly common nationwide. There are far more efforts these days to fire college professors over what they say.
And that's it for headlines.
The New York State Senate and Assembly have each released their one-house budget resolutions, setting the stage for a final budget agreement by April 1st. Blair Horner of NYPIRG discusses with Mark how things stand on climate, higher education, and public campaign finance.
We're joined by Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, New York Public Interest Research Group. This week, particularly mid-March, the two houses of the state legislature release their responses to the governor's budget proposals. And now we begin apparently a two-week dash to finish up the budget. We are going to talk to Blair about a number of key issues, but there are certain things in the budget that NYPIRG doesn't particularly focus on. There is going to be a dispute over taxes. The legislature wants to raise taxes on the wealthy, whereas the governor wants some taxes on the MTA. One of my all-time issues, universal school meals, had a big win, $280 million for school meals. And on housing, that's, you know, one of the governor's big priorities is to build affordable housing. but the legislature apparently does not agree with how they deal with it. So let's turn to what, you know, Blair, in terms of the issues that you guys cover, like environmental issues, healthcare, higher education, and democracy. What were some of the most notable things about the budget?
Well, thanks for having me. And you're right. It's showtime when it comes to the budget. My guess is that it'll be late because it always is, but not very late. We'll see how it all goes. I mean, in the area of climate, there'll be some big issues that'll be debated. The governor, for example, advanced a proposal to require electrification of certain buildings over a certain period of time. And that means that the power that the building would have to be powered by electricity, not fossil fuel. The governor had a proposal to do that with certain dates, basically by 2026 for small buildings and 2029 for larger buildings. Both houses of the legislature advanced their own plans. The dates are really, there are differences, but, you know, there seems to be conceptual agreement that at some point in the relatively near future, all new building construction in New York State will be powered by electricity instead of fossil fuels. So then,
Jump in there quickly. So we build about 50,000 or less new buildings a year, and there's 5 million existing buildings. The governor surprisingly actually proposed a timeline to phase out gas in existing buildings, but apparently the legislature is not going along with that one.
That's right. The governor had, which of course makes perfect sense, to say that in the same way that New York has a law in the books that says that starting in the year 2035, fossil fuel powered cars won't be allowed to be sold, new cars. And so the governor's proposal was in this budget that, well, you know, if we're going to phase out the use of fossil fuels, we should say by a date certain. That New York will not allow the sale of appliances that rely on gas power, most notably gas stoves. But she backed off that a little bit, and both houses of the legislature backed off the proposal in toto. So I don't know what's going to happen on that, but I think that, you know, as a practical matter, that's where the world is going to end up anyway. And so, you know, the attacks on the governor's proposal, particularly around the issue of gas stoves, is so, you know, incredibly bogus. It's hard to sort of deal with sometimes, but the legislature reacted to it and didn't include that.
But we only have 10 minutes. One of the things that the Senate did put in was something that NYPERG has been pushing, which is the Climate Superfund Act. I think raises about $3 billion a year over a period of time. So that was a little bit surprising. But how is funding coming for climate in this budget?
Well, I mean, the governor's proposal to the cap and invest proposal is really the only real revenue that's drive new revenue source that'll be used for climate change. And God knows if that'll happen. The assembly and the Senate, you know, the Senate wants to do it, but in a different way. And so I'm not sure that one. I don't know how that will make the end. But you're right that the state needs enormous sums to deal with the damage caused by a rapidly warming planet. And the Senate proposal, which is not embraced by the governor nor the assembly, so we'll see how that plays out, is to tag the oil companies, the biggest oil companies, the most profitable oil companies on the planet, to pick up some of the tab for the cost. And $3 billion a year for the next 25 years is the proposal that the Senate advanced. We're hoping that goes in. I mean, these costs are going to have to be paid by somebody. And right now, it's the average taxpayer is going to pay for it. And so we think the oil company should pick up the tab because they're responsible and they have the money.
Now, we could spend the whole time on climate, and a lot of people are very focused on what's going on with New York, the idea about getting NYPA, New York Power Authority, build public renewables, but a lot of other issues. And some people may forget that NYPA is actually a student organization. So it seemed like the legislature is at least backing you guys in terms of opposition to the SUNY tuition increase that the governor proposed. How is higher education in general doing?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, higher education, particularly the smaller four-year colleges and the community colleges, are in terrible financial shape. And the governor's proposal really didn't do anything to reverse that trend. All she did, in fact, was propose the tuition could go up. And I mean, that's the policy path that has led New York to the situation it's in now. So both houses of the legislature reject the governor's proposal to increase tuition. They restore the governor's proposed cuts to so-called opportunity programs. Those are programs to help qualified students that go to college, to provide them additional assistance to deal with, you know, college needs. They both houses increase in different ways, but increase the base aid that the state's providing to both public colleges and community colleges. And so the legislature is sort of stepping up to the plate. But what really is needed is something really big in terms of comprehensive response, because the state's public colleges are in bad shape financially, except for the university centers. And some of the smaller private colleges are in bad shape. Cazenovia College, which has been around for 200 years, is closing its doors at the end of the spring semester. And so these are problems. And higher education is not only important in terms of educating young people and giving them experience in civic life. They're also little mini economic development engines to churn out jobs and have a ripple effect on the local economies where they're located. And when you let them go down the drain, you're hurting yourself in many ways beyond just the fact that college students won't have the choices that they have right now.
Now, let's talk a little bit about democracy rights. And one of the things that Nyberg and others have worked for many years was system of partial public campaign finance, and actually kicked in earlier this year. Seemed like the assembly, now you're getting close to actually doing public campaign finance, and was balking a bit, and particularly since they're going to have to rerun with new lines because of the court cases, they were getting a little bit nervous that power of incumbency might not be enough. But apparently there's at least some movement in the budget to actually put money on the table.
Yeah, it's sort of. I mean, the governor proposed $25 million toward the public financing system. As you're quite right, New York currently has now a public financing system, a voluntary system where candidates can join. They get matched public dollars for small private donations that the candidate gets.
This is state races, not local races.
That's right. It's all state legislature and statewide. And so nobody has to join, nobody has to participate, but, you know, it's a very lucrative program. It's complicated. It's more complicated than New York City system. So we'll see how it plays out. But the governor put $25 million on the table. The Senate matched it. And so I think that there is a, you know, reasonably good chance that there will be public financing at the end of the day, because somewhere there has to be money, public match for the small donations, and the state has to do that. Now, the assembly, you're right, is getting colder feet as it gets closer to showtime. The argument about the lines, of course, is an argument you could have every 10 years. And so you think that they would have figured it out by now. The law passed in 2019, went into effect the day after the election in November 22. And so there's no reason why all of a sudden it should become as a shock to lawmakers that this system's going into place.
So we only have about 45 seconds yet. I know one of the big fights was Medicaid, some course shifting that the governor wanted to the counties was struck down. Last 30 seconds, what are the other big budget issues people should be aware of?
Well, one of the ones was the governor proposes to increase the state cigarette tax and yet provided no money to help smokers to quit, which just seems ridiculous. The Senate added $30 million to the program to do that. Both houses, though, rejected the governor's proposal to get rid of flavored tobacco. In sort of an Orwellian sort of argument, apparently an industry that figures out how to target blacks to get addicted to the deadly product. It's a problem when you try to get them to stop. But so we'll see how that plays out, too, in terms of flavored tobacco products, as well as the cigarette tax.
Nyberg, nyberg.org. We'll have a little chart up, I believe, in a couple of days. Blair Horner, executive director, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Now, just to clarify, the Senate and the Assembly have put out what's called their One House budget resolutions. Now they have to negotiate both among themselves between the two parties, but also with the governor. And so I don't want to sound like just because it's in the One House budget resolutions, that in fact it's a done deal. It's a lot of money, over $220 billion, and we will be providing updated stories as we get closer to the April 1st deadline. And most people are speculating that this is going to be a relatively late budget.
For our Peace Bucket, Mark Dunley spoke with Tom Ellis about the upcoming vigil in memory of a U.S.-American activist killed while defending a Palestinian home.
For this week's Peace Bucket, we talk with Tom Ellis, who is a member of the Palestinian Rights Committee. And on March 16, 2003, human rights activist Rachel Corrie was killed as Israeli forces were bulldozing a house of a Palestinian pharmacist and his family in the Rafah refugee camp. So on March 16th of this year in Townsend Park in Albany, Crossing the Social Justice Center at 4:30, the Palestinian Rights Committee, Jewish Voice for Peace, and others are holding a vigil in Rachel's memory. So Tom, you know, why have groups decided to do a vigil in Rachel's name?
So why are we doing the vigil? We do this vigil each year. It's to remind Americans that Rachel paid the supreme sacrifice, that the Palestinian struggle for equality with Israel hasn't ended, that it continues even after all of these years, that she was a tremendous young woman. She would be doing great work if she was alive now. It's to honor her. And it's a vigil. It's not a demonstration, but it's a chance for people to show their support for Palestinian rights and to call for reconciliation between the Israelis and the Palestinians so that there can be truly a lasting, warm peace between them.
Now, I understood that Rachel, you know, was with some other international human rights observer, and they stood up and, you know, tried to persuade the bulldoze operator not to demolish the house. Was anybody held, you know, liable either criminally or civilly for having killed Rachel?
I'm nearly certain that nobody was held, that nobody was arrested or held or imprisoned for doing it. So she was standing in front of the house. It was a giant bulldozer. The driver clearly saw her as the bulldozer came closer. It pushed the dirt up. So she was being pushed up, and then she slid down in front of the bulldozer and got run over, and then the bulldozer driver backed up over her. She was crushed and injured and died a few minutes later.
So what is the Palestinian Rights Committee and the other groups hoping, you know, will occur by holding, you know, this vigil?
Well, I don't think that any of us expect that us holding a vigil here in Albany is going to change anything in Palestine or in Israel. But like I said, it's a chance to educate the public, to inform the public. Hopefully that, in addition to your radio station, that other news outlets will report on it. We want to show the public that there is a lot of support for Palestinian rights and for ending the conflict. We have 9 different groups that are co-sponsoring it, which is more than we've ever had in any of the previous ones.
Now, there has been a lot of media attention recently because the old government, which is now the new government, has proposed various rules to really restrict the judiciary, probably because, I guess, the president or premier himself is under investigation for corruption, and hundreds of thousands of people have been demonstrating in Israel. But that doesn't seem to be much about the rights of the Palestinians. It seems to be more about undermining democracy and the court system in Israel. What's the situation with the Palestinian and the occupied territories at this point?
Well, there's 2 parts to your question. The first is that you're correct that these demonstrations that are occurring in Israel, it's really like the far right is protesting against the extreme far right in Israel. And the demonstrations that are occurring have nothing to do with the Palestinians or their right, their demand for equal justice. In fact, one Palestinian woman was invited to speak at a demonstration in, I think, around the 18th or so of February, and the organizers wanted to see her speech. And they said, oh, it's just a formality, a technicality. And then when they saw the speech, they told her that she was going to have to revise it, and she refused it. And her name is Reem Hazan, R-E-E-M-H-A-Z-Z-A-N. And part of what she was going to say was, we will feel partners, and we will be partners to the struggle. And the goal will be to change the policies of racism and discrimination and establish the new social contract based on the pursuit of peace and equality, when the fight for democracy will aim for real democracy, not democracy only for Jews, but democracy for everyone. So, and you asked about what's happening in Palestine right now. The level of violence is pretty high. The Israelis are killing a Palestinian person on average more than one a day. I mean, it's been higher than that in the years past when they did these wars and massacres in Gaza. But the one thing that's very disconcerting is that in a Palestinian village of Huwara on February 26th, perhaps hundreds of Israeli settlers rampaged through the village, and they torched at least six houses and dozens of cars, and they some of them stopped and prayed as the fire was consuming these houses. And an Israeli government official liked the tweet that he saw, and he basically was calling for the destruction of the village. And so that's one thing that's happening. There's a lot of violence. I mean, the Palestinians are doing some of the violence. They're killing Israelis, but the Israelis are killing way more Palestinians. And it's the same strategy that the Israelis have used many times in the past, that we're, you know, it isn't like an eye for an eye. It's like 10 dead Palestinians or 10 killed Palestinians for one killed Israelis. So they always respond with overkill. And I believe that the Israeli government wants to have some level of Palestinian violence in order to justify the enormous Israeli military expenditures and the repression that is ongoing. The Gaza Strip has remained under siege now for 15 years by Israel, with some help from Egypt and from the United States, immoral support and military weapons. Palestinians are being evicted from their homes. Homes are being demolished. It's the same thing that's been occurring for years. Maybe, you know, it ebbs and flows. It gets better or maybe less bad. It's a horrible situation for the Palestinians. In the West Bank, they've lived under martial law for more than 55 years. Palestinians haven't had elections since 2005. The last time they had elections, Hamas won, and the Israelis arrested some of their leaders. The Palestinian president Abbas is a very old man now, and his term of office expired, I think, at least 10 years ago. There's a lot of bad politics. There's many Palestinians who I think would love to just have all new leadership for their struggle. Basically,
so we have about 90 seconds left. Now, of course, support for Israel has always been a bipartisan, you know, both major political parties, you know, strongly support Israel and not very strong on Palestinian. But, you know, with the Biden administration, they've been in here for 2 years now. Has there been any, you know, effort to strike a little bit more of a pro-Palestinian position, at least in terms of trying to ramp down the economic stranglehold in the last 60 seconds or so?
No, I would say there hasn't been. Biden has not undone some of the Trump policies of moving the embassy to Jerusalem or endorsing or the annexation of the Golan Heights. Biden really is really no better than the prior presidents on this issue. It's not a good scene at all with him.
Palestinian Rights Committee, Tom, you have a website?
We're going to have a website soon. You know,
okay.
We're a little bit behind technologically, but we will have a website soon.
Okay, we're talking with Tom Ellis, a member of the Palestinian Rights Committee, on March 16th at the Townsend Park across from Social Justice Center on Central Avenue in Albany, 4:30 to 5:30 vigil for Rachel Corrie. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I will note there are news reports out this morning that former Governor Andrew Cuomo is setting up a new Israeli support group in New York. And I also see that Senator Gillibrand is saying that she is hearing that Mr. Cuomo will be running for her United States Senate seat. There is actually going to be a large peace rally this Saturday in D.C., probably the biggest rally to date against the war, at least in the United States. And we'll try to have some coverage on next week's Peace Bucket about that. But for those who are just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And if you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend, neighbor, coworker, stranger on the bus, person you meet at the local pizza place. You can find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
Dr. David Carpenter, whose academic freedom was recently challenged by SUNY Albany and Monsanto, will be recognized for his decades of public service when he receives the Good Trouble Award at an event at the Sanctuary for Independent Media this Sunday, March 19th. Mark spoke with Sarah Ataru, a PhD student of Dr. Carpenter.
On this Sunday, March 19th, the Sanctuary for Independent Media is holding a celebration to award Professor David Carpenter the Good Trouble Award for various work he's done over the years on environmental issues. That'll be at the Sanctuary Independent Media, 3361 6th Avenue, North Troy, from 2 to 5 p.m. And so we've invited on Sarah Ataru, who is one of the students of Dr. Carpenter, who teaches at SUNY Albany. So, Sarah, welcome. And maybe just give us a little introduction. You know, what are you studying with Dr. Carpenter?
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Sarah Ataru, and I'm a third-year PhD student with Dr. David Carpenter. I'm currently studying the effects of glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in many weed killers that are used around the world. And I'm studying the effect of that chemical on the endocrine system. So that's, and then I'm originally from Nigeria, and I've been in the U.S. since 2015, and I got to meet Dr. Carpenter in 2021 when I got to UAlbany.
Now, you mentioned this was, you know, a weed killer, and one of the reasons why Dr. Carpenter was initially restricted on his teaching activities was because Monsanto, which, among other things, had produced PCBs, had basically asked SUNY Albany some questions because Dr. Carpenter had often testified as an expert witness. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe Monsanto also is involved with various weed killers. Yes. Are you ever involved in providing expert testimony? And why would such expert testimony actually, you know, be important?
Well, I've never been involved in providing expert testimony, but I think that these testimonies are very important because it is good to hear from the people in the field who have spent like a large part of their lives and careers studying these things, studying these chemicals and their various effects in health. And many times, like members of the public depend on these experts to, you know, give like their unbiased view and interpretation of the effects of these chemicals. So it is very important.
Now, when I graduated actually from RPI in law school many, many decades ago, yes, one of my initial jobs as a community organizer was out in Arizona, and we were working then because in this low-income Mexican-American neighborhood that was surrounded by cotton fields, and they were spraying the cotton fields with this new pesticide called Polestar, and that was actually killing a lot of the animals and causing pregnant women to miscarry. You know, do these companies not do adequate testing before they put out these various chemicals for use?
Well, I don't know that much about the like internal operations of many of these companies, but I would expect that multi-million dollar companies such as Monsanto should do their due diligence to find out the effects of these chemicals. And if indeed they're found to be harmful to the general public, then don't prioritize profit over people's lives.
Now you mentioned you're from Nigeria, so you know, why did you end up in snowy upstate New York with Dr. Carpenter?
Okay, well, because I have had my own trials. So I'm 35 years old, and I have two children now, thankfully. But before, there was a space of 9 years before I was able to have my second child, and that was via IVF. And so prior to that time, I kept on having like miscarriages, and I did all the tests in the hospital back home, and they said everything was normal, but it was kind of unusual for someone at my age to not be able to conceive if everything is, you know, okay. And so I started looking for solutions, went to hospitals, and they finally came out with a diagnosis of ovarian insufficiency. And I was like, what would cause that, you know? And then gradually that led me to do my own research, and I started looking into chemicals and the effect of chemicals on health and all of that. And yeah, so I'm here today.
So, you know, what is it like, you know, working with, you know, Dr. Carpenter, and you know, what is sort of his reputation in the field, you know, for looking at some of the, you know, environmental and health problems caused by these various chemicals?
Well, I would say that, first of all, Dr. Carpenter is like one of the professors in the department with the highest number of international students. So I guess that in itself speaks to his reputation. Many of us wouldn't have known about this institution were it not for the research of people like Dr. Carpenter.
And what do you hope to do once you graduate?
Well, once I graduate, I hope to continue research in this field, and maybe my research will be translated to, you know, policy to help people.
Now, you know, so Monsanto, I mean, the situation was when Dr. Carpenter testifies as an expert witness about PCBs, he actually usually donates the any expert fees he gets either to, I guess, some of the graduate students,
yes,
or to or back, you know, to the university. I mean, how important has Dr. Carpenter's, you know, testimony been?
It's been very important. Like, so most of what he gets from those testimonies is what he uses to support many of us. Many of us came, especially to UAlbany, you know, expecting to be funded. But things, when it comes to funding, things are not always straightforward. But Dr. Carpenter has, you know, graciously taken many of us under his wings, and he has ensured that we have adequate support for our various, you know, projects that we're doing with him.
So, you know, what was, you know, the student sort of response when they heard that, you know, SUNY Albany was restricting Dr. Carpenter's, you know, teaching ability, you know, because Monsanto had asked, you know, some questions. Do you think that was a fair response?
No, I don't think that was a fair response. I felt like the school should have done a lot more to, you know, support him, especially a researcher of his standing and given the amount of years and work that he has put into this institution, I felt that more could have been done to support him and also for all the students that are under him. Like, I feel the school didn't do enough to ensure that if he was going to be away, then there should have been, you know, adequate provision for us. It's not easy to just toss a student to another advisor just on a whim without any warning, no notice, nothing, and expect that everything will be okay. I mean, before we come into the PhD program, we spend a lot of time researching the people that we want to work with. So you can just come on one day and say, okay, go work with this person because your mentor has been restricted from coming to school, and then there's no support. And many of us felt like we were really in the dark and we felt abandoned.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Sarah Otaru, who is a PhD student with Dr. Carpenter at SUNY Albany. This Sunday, March 19th, Dr. Carpenter is getting the Good Trouble Award, and it's Century Independent Media, PAWS, Riverkeeper, Beyond Plastics, many other groups, and that will be from 2 to 5 p.m., 3361 6th Avenue. You can register at Sanctuary for Independent Media or MediaSanctuary.org. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So we'll be doing a couple more interviews about this event in the next couple days. As we said, you can go to Media Sanctuary, look at the event page to get more information. And I understand there will be some vegetable soup, so it should be a good time for all.
For our next story, Saratoga resident Jean Fay has devoted over 25 years to bringing Dismantle Racism workshops to the Capital Region. Marsha Lazarus spoke with her. This is part two of their interview.
I was very intrigued, Jean, learning that you founded the Seven Dancers Coalition to prevent and end sexual and domestic violence targeting Native women.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Marsha Lazarus and am delighted to be talking with Saratoga resident Jean Fay as part of a series on meaningful work in the Capital Region.
You make beautiful pottery, Jean. You drum with the Albany Women's Drum Circle. And I know you dance. Can you talk about the connection between your artistic and rhythm pursuits and empowerment and inclusiveness work?
Yeah, I had just always enjoyed modern dance as a child, and then living all around the world, seeing women in all different kinds of cultures. So I think it was just being exposed to many, many versions of beauty and grace and womanhood, and just being very attracted to all of that. The Seven Dancers Coalition was established with federal money that I applied for and received, and I worked with the Akwesasne up on the St. Regis Mohawk Reservation to develop it. The Seven Dancers is actually a story about seven children who were abused in their homes and who went up to the stars and form a star pattern up there. But it's the story is about recognizing domestic violence and sexual assault. And so one of the things that I have admired about the Native Americans that I've met and worked with is their resilience and the fact that they still have this wonderful sense of humor. And they still, for all the trauma that they experience and are experiencing every day, they have like the highest suicide rates amongst their children. Native American woman is more likely to be raped than any other woman from any other racial category. So to look at how can they keep their resilience strong and their culture strong to survive for 500 years under this oppression. And that really ties into the trauma-informed care and the way that music and rhythm and dance can be wordless ways for us to build community, for us to talk to each other. I heard a military man talking about trauma-informed care. And he said, you put a cat in your backyard, and if you drop bombs on your backyard all day long, at the end of the day, you're going to have a different cat. And so that's just kind of the effect that trauma has on us. So we don't even know who we really are without that trauma. You know, the person without the fear or the, you know, drug abuse. You know, if you suffer four things out of four events out of 10 possible kinds of events, you're more likely to be a heavy cigarette smoker than somebody who suffered none of those events. And that might be like witnessing domestic violence in your own home. It might be having a single family parent, you know, with somebody missing in your family. So the 10 things can lead to overweight, the total correlation with weight. So when you see heavy people, I don't see heavy people. I see people who are traumatized and trying to help themselves through their pain. Same thing when I see alcoholics and drug abusers. They're self-medicating to try and help themselves get through some kind of pain.
You've written and sent around some beautiful poems connected to the drumming and the importance of listening to the drum within each of us.
So, you know, so when we do experience trauma, you know, we experience it in our mind, but our body holds the traces of it. And so drumming is a way to get that out. So you release the drumming. And once you can release the drumming, you can release your emotions and kind of go through those experiences. You know, there's also things like tapping, which help you, you know, you tap on it, your body and face and shoulders in a certain sequence. And that helps take the trauma out of your memory, you know, of, say, being raped or whatever. It helps you be able to go through life more easily.
Your appreciation of differences and your natural instinct, Gene, to not make something hierarchical, one better than the other, is so evident. It's very beautiful. And I was very intrigued, Gene, by the Our Story treasure hunt that you organized.
That was part of MLK Day, Saratoga. Big team of people came together to create the treasure hunt. It was an idea I had, but it took many hands and many stories to reach down into our community and bring back those memories. And then also to stitch it all together into a whole piece that's interactive and that's living and alive. Leslie Dana, she deserves recognition for the labor that she put into this to create a beautiful product and creating the treasure hunt. For me, it always been knowing that there was a Native American presence here and seeing the painting on the city hall, you know, meeting room of Native Americans. And then it's like, and then Gideon Putnam arrived and then wipes out every other trace. And so for a long time, I'd been thinking about where is that story and how can we get that to be back into our curriculum and into understanding, you know, who we are today. It started with Native Americans, but of course there was the history of our urban renewal funds being used to wipe out the Black community in Saratoga and displacing them and shutting down their businesses. We started looking at the town and looking at the urban renewal and what was gone. And it was like, well, let's try and resurface that. Why don't we try and have a treasure hunt? It was quite a journey finding out more and more. And we found so many threads, you know, there was a Mohawk, there was a hunting trail that went from Canada through Saratoga all the way down to Schenectady. And so we've got that path, and we can tell somebody, you can go walk on this path. So we set it up as a treasure hunt, as kind of giving a sort of clues. And then once you get to the clue, you can open up the story and it'll tell you, you know, the history of that spot, who had lived there and been there before. There's a woman in town named Carol Daggs who had her grandparents were here. They'd owned land for, and yet people are saying, you know, you don't, you know, there's no Black people in Saratoga. And so she's been trying to reclaim the space, the farm that they owned, the, you know, their homes, their community, the humans that, you know, peopled it. And so she was a very big part of the Our Story. She'd done a lot of research, and also she's developed walking tours now. So a different series of walking tours, and her book about the farm and the land and people has been selected to be one of the readings for a local reading group now. We're trying to be very inclusive and bring in all kinds of historical experiences. Leslie Dana found people who were experts in different areas of Saratoga history. Our Jewish community, our history there is quite deep and not very much spoken about. And so, again, I think many people are very interested in wanting to explore and find out what they haven't been taught.
And Jean, just to share my own experience coming to Drum Circle at your home, I always used to look forward to it before the pandemic, right? But the composition of the drummers, different colors and backgrounds of all of us at your home, all enjoying together, just to me always spoke so much about you and that it wasn't just about your work, but it was how you've created your life. And I think that's very, very beautiful and very powerful.
Thank you very much.
And so that was Marcia Lazarus talking to Saratoga residents Jean Fai. And if you want to hear part one of that segment, you can go to mediasanctuary.org and just type in Jean, F-E-I, and it will pop up.
To close out tonight's program, we're now joined by Matthew Shapiro, Senior Director of Government Affairs at National Alliance on Mental Illness, New York State, also known as NAMI. Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
So the last time we spoke, you were talking about the need to increase support for the mental health workforce, saying that there can't be any services without sustainable working conditions for the people who are at the foundation of these services. Can you talk about the cost of living adjustment that you'd like to see and why that's important?
Certainly. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this important issue. You know, our number one priority has always been expanding mental health services and access to mental health services. New Yorkers all over the state, including here in the Capital Region, struggle to locate services. And once they do, there's usually long wait times till they get services. It could be weeks, it could be months. And one of the big reasons because of this is there's just not enough workers and case managers and counselors to handle the growing need. So, you know, one of the things that's long been a concern from us is that people are leaving the industry in droves, and we really need to stabilize the mental health industry that provide community support. So, you know, we've been advocating for a long time. We call it caring for those who care for us, and fighting for the mental health or behavioral health workforce. And, you know, we've been asking for an 8.5% cost of living adjustment, which would address years of underfunding. I've been with NAMI now for almost 15 years, and only twice in that time has the workforce gone a COLA. They got a 3.5 a few years ago and a 5.5 last year. But again, that doesn't erase decades of flat funding to them and underfunding. So, we have advocated for the 8.5. Governor Hochul in her budget proposal put in 2.5 for a COLA, and we've really worked with the legislature to try to up that. And when both the One House bills came out yesterday, we were really pleased to see both of them carry the 8.5 ask. So now we'll see how the negotiations go, but we are very encouraged to see the broad support in the legislature for that.
So, Matt, next week, NAMI will be holding a press conference. I guess one of the key issues is hospital reforms. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So there's really two things we want to see. And thank you, Mark. It's such an important issue. And I just want to start, you know, whenever we talk about hospitals and psychiatric hospitals, I'm always very quick to point out that in no way are we looking to go back to the problems of yesterday when we overutilized hospitals and asylums and things like that. We don't want to return to that, but we do know that hospitals do play a vital role as a part of continuum of care for people who have psychiatric ailments and mental illness. So, you know, over the last 10 years, New York State has lost over 1,700 hospital beds from our system, both in the Office of Mental Health public system and through the private system. You know, in the public sense, for a long time, the state looked to fund community-based services off the backs of hospital beds. So they would look to reduce a hospital bed out of the OMH system, and for every bed reduced, they would invest $100,000 into the community system. So it was kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. So one of the things that Governor Hochul is trying to do is return 1,000 of those beds back online. 150 beds back into the OMH system, which is great. And then the other thing that really caused a great reduction in psychiatric beds is during COVID, Governor Cuomo had put in a mandate, which had made sense at the time, that all hospitals should have 30% of their beds available in case of a surge in a different part of the state if they had to move people around. But the problem was that most hospitals disproportionately targeted psychiatric beds to meet those needs and to meet that mandate. And they were reduced at great numbers. I mean, for example, south of here in Kingston, the hospital there was the only psychiatric bed provider for three different counties. And, you know, their whole unit closed. And now none of those people in three counties have access to these hospitals. And how is this impacting New York families? I can tell you, one of our family friends had to take their daughter to the psychiatric emergency room here in Albany at the Capital District Psych Center. There weren't any beds available for her 16-year-old daughter, and she had transferred all the way down to Westchester, to Valhalla. And again, that's 2 hours away. It separates a young woman who's in distress from her family, from her support system. And we see things like this all the time, people getting moved as far as way to Buffalo to access a bed. So this is really impacting New Yorkers in a great way. So, you know, what the governor is trying to do is for all these hospitals that cut psych beds to meet that mandate, he wants to fine them $2,000 a day for failure to bring those beds back online, which is something we certainly support. Unfortunately, in the One Houses, it's been watered down a little bit. I believe in the Assembly bill, they want to knock that down to 1,000. The Senate bill is even a little more vague about how they would deal with it. But the most important thing is we need to get these beds back online. And the other thing that we want to see, Mark, that's so important is reforms in how hospitals admit people, and more importantly, how they discharge people. We've been fighting for these reforms for a long time. In 2019, we introduced something called Nicole's Law, which would address these issues and ensure that people get person-centered care while coming into the hospital, don't repeat practices that have failed them in the past, and make sure they get person-centered care and try to engage the families and get family insight as well. But more importantly, upon discharge, they would immediately connect them to mental health services in the community. You know, like I said, people have ridiculous wait times. I mean, right here in the Capital Region, I had to wait 7 weeks to see a therapist. And, you know, I wasn't in a vulnerable state at that point, thank God, where I was psychotic or clinically depressed, where I could have hurt myself or something like that, or decompensated. But especially when people are coming out of a very structured environment, such as a hospital setting, we want them connected to services right away. I mean, we've heard just the most egregious discharge practices you've ever heard. You know, Nicole Atter, who the law is named after, she was hospitalized 5 times in a 6-month period in New York City. And in none of the cases were her discharge planning appropriate. Her family, even though she had waived HIPAA rights and they were her power of attorney, were never notified upon her discharge. In fact, one time she was discharged with still the paper slippers on her feet, because when she came in on the emergency room, she didn't have shoes on because they brought her in by ambulance. Instead of calling her family and saying, hey, we're discharging Nicole, she doesn't have shoes, she doesn't have the proper clothes, come and take her and bring her, what she needs, they literally let her out in the streets of New York with paper slippers on her feet.
Matt, if I could get a follow-up question in here. Sure. So partly about the discharge and partly about the idea they were shutting down hospital beds and moving people into the community. Have they, in fact, created enough beds in the community for people? And was one of the things where the governor was talking about affordable housing was actually trying to get some funds to build more community bed supported housing for people with mental health issues that would need additional support. How is that moving forward?
Yeah, so we're very excited about that. I'm glad you brought that up, Mark. You know, obviously, we know that hospitals aren't the best place to drive recovery. They have a purpose. It's a very acute period of time, and we want people connected to community services. And like you said, especially housing services that provide wraparound services. So it's not only giving somebody a bed and a roof over their head, it's having a case manager that will get them to appointments, make sure they take their medication and everything else one would need to recover. So we're very glad to see that the governor proposed expanding mental health housing programs. She's proposed 3,500 new units, all different kinds. These kind of things, they're like a pyramid. They kind of start with the most structured and try to graduate people towards independence. So we're really glad to see that. We're also really glad to see crisis stabilization housing in the governor's proposal. You know, I've discussed on the show before the crisis respite centers we want to see that can treat people for 23 hours and 59 minutes. But what happens after that, and creating a special type of housing for someone coming out of a crisis situation and addressing the unique needs that they may have, is something we're really encouraged by, because we know recovery happens best within the community and not within hospitals. And mental health housing programs are such an integral part of that. So thank you for bringing that up as well.
We have about 30 seconds left, and something else that you're addressing in that press conference is insurance parity issues. Can you just kind of sum up what that means? I had to look up parity.
Sure. So too many providers, private insurance plans, don't cover psychiatric issues the way they would cover physical issues. And of course, we always say you can't have health without mental health, or and mental health without health. It's like, you know, they're integral to each other. So we want, you know, stronger reforms to ensure insurance parity, that psychiatric issues can get billed the same way. Again, encourage that the initiative was in both the governor's proposal and the Senate One House bill. We have some work to do next week to get the assembly on board, but that's a crucial piece to access. You know, insurance issues do create a great barrier to care.
Thank you so much, Matthew Shapiro from NAMI, for joining us. It's always great to have you on. We've been having you on monthly, so I do hope that we'll talk to you again next month.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And I guess that's our show.
Oh, that was my line. And we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Vasilahicky.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Thank you, Sina, being our engineer. And we want to thank Marcia Lazarus for her segment. And we appreciate you all listening and tuning in. Until next time.